This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Israel raids suspects' homes after kidnapped teens are found dead. Reaction to ISIL declaring a new caliphate.
It indicates that ISIS or ISIL is thinking of a long-term presence in a large geographic space, a big part of Iraq and Syria.
Japanese lawmakers take a historic step away from the country's pacifist constitution. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Israeli troops have raided the homes of two men suspected of abducting three Israeli teenagers, whose bodies were found Monday nearly 3 weeks after they disappeared. Television footage showed troops setting off explosions at the home of Amr Abu Asseh early today in Hebron. Witnesses reported a similar operation at the home of Marwan Gamaswe. Israel says the two men are members of the militant group Hamas, who has denied any involvement in the teenagers' disappearance. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Monday that Hamas will pay a heavy price after the teens were killed by what he called human animals. The three Israeli teenagers went missing while hitchhiking home from school near Hebron on June 12th. Media reports say their bodies were found near the location where they disappeared. After word got out the teens' bodies had been found, people began to gather at the site to pray. Ari Silverman was among them.
Everyone's very distressed and upset. It's obviously something that we knew was a possibility, something that we prayed that wouldn't happen. And I think people have come here at the moment because at a time like this, we need to pray and be together and strengthen Am Yisrael, strengthen the army that protects us, and be together and to pray.
Since the teens' disappearance, Israeli-Palestinian tensions have spiked. Prime Minister Netanyahu has demanded that Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas give up a reconciliation deal with Hamas. At Monday's U.S. State Department press briefing, spokesperson Jennifer Psaki was asked about all this.
We have been in touch with both sides and have been urging continued security cooperation, that the Israelis and the Palestinians continue to work with one another on that, and we certainly would continue to urge that in spite of, obviously, the tragedy and the enormous pain on the ground.
U.S. State Department spokesperson Jennifer Psaki. Iraq's new parliament has ended its first session without selecting a new prime minister. The lawmakers met today for the first time since being elected in late April, but acting speaker Mahdi al-Hafdi ended the session after a number of members failed to return from a break. He said they would continue in a week if there is a possibility of an agreement. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki was a favorite to claim his third term after the election, but since then Sunni Islamist militants have captured large areas of northern and western Iraq and thrown the country into chaos. Western leaders have urged Iraqi officials to form an inclusive government to counter sectarian divisions among its Shiite, Sunni, and Kurdish populations. ISIL has declared that its chief, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, is the leader of a new caliphate, a historical term to denote a sovereign state for the Muslim faithful. The term was last widely recognized to describe the government of the Ottoman Empire. ISIL was once al-Qaeda's affiliate in Iraq, but the terror group's leaders disowned ISIL early this year for its desire to crave out a caliphate and refusing to obey orders. Paul Salin is the vice president for policy and research at the Middle East Institute. We asked for his reaction to the new caliphate being announced.
It adds a new level, a new dimension to the dramatic events that have been taking place over the last few weeks. I think it indicates that ISIS or ISIL is thinking of a long-term presence in a large geographic space, a big part of Iraq and Syria. I had written previously that I think this is a development which will be with us for a long time. Because the Shiite-led governments, both in Baghdad and Damascus, have failed to bring in the Sunnis. And this sort of breakaway by Sunni communities, at this point, using ISIS or accepting ISIS as a spearhead, reflects a larger political, you know, malaise or, you know, division in the region. I don't think ISIS's dominance in this region will be uncontested or necessarily very long-term. I think the fact that they went ahead and declared a state, as it were, might in fact bring them even more rapidly into conflict with other groups, in these contested zones. At the same time, I think this declaration does reverberate around the Islamic world among radicals and jihadis, that this is sort of putting forward a sort of the skeleton of a new project, which is to bring back the caliphate. This has been part of Islamist radical discourse for a whole century, since the caliphate was abolished by the Turks in 1924. So this will resonate and might have sort of reverberations in other countries and communities who might look favorably at this development. So I think it's significant. It complicates the situation even more than it was. But it will not, be uncontested. It won't be as if they're just going to go ahead and set up an Islamic State and a caliph, and that's just going to be accepted as part of the normality. But it does throw a new concept into the mix.
How should the international community react to this, or should they react at all?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's much to react in terms of the, the declaration or not. This is a group that, Al-Qaeda declares things, this group declares things. It's not, it's not as if there is now a caliphate that one has to, take positions for or against. So I wouldn't necessarily think that the international community per se needs to react to the declaration. I think that is more something of concern to the Muslim world, Islamic countries, for whom, this is part of their history and positions as Islamic societies or states. They will definitely take positions about, largely, I would imagine, nobody will accept it. I don't think the West needs to, react to it per se. The West needs to, and the international community needs to react to, what's going on, broadly in Syria and Iraq, the disintegration effectively of that entire part of the Middle East. Obviously, great loss of life, great instability, a great risk to security, not only in the region, but also Western security, since there are hundreds of Western fighters fighting in Syria and Iraq with these jihadi groups, and some of them are already coming home and do pose a risk. The West really has not had a policy, or at least an effective policy, to deal with this double crisis of Syria and Iraq, and they really sort of have merged into one terrible, perfect storm. That needs addressing. But the caliphate, somebody announces a caliphate, I don't think necessarily the international community needs to take a position on it.
Paul Zeilin, Vice President for Policy and Research at the Middle East Institute. Tomorrow we ask what world leaders should do next concerning the crisis in the region.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Japanese lawmakers today took a historic step away from the country's pacifist constitution and approved the right to collective self-defense, or the ability to come to the aid of a friendly country, a move that pleases Washington and angers Beijing. China, which is involved in a territorial dispute with Japan, says Tokyo is challenging the post-war order and raising regional tensions. The move is also opposed by some in South Korea, which, along with China, was a major victim of Japanese colonial aggression. Japan has been operating under a U.S.-drafted post-war constitution that includes Article 9, which renounces war and the threat and use of force to settle disputes, and states that land, sea, and air forces, along with war potential, will never be maintained. Jeffrey Harnug, associate professor at the Hawaii-based Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the specifics of the revised security policy have yet to be spelled out in legislation, and he expects some limitations. He says the United States welcomes the announcement, having long advocated a more proactive Japanese security presence. Harnug does not believe this move guts Article 9.
I don't believe it does. You still have a lot of restrictions. The thing about when Japanese policies change, they usually put a lot of restrictions in place afterwards. It is a change. Article 9 is still in place. It still has a policy of defensive defense, what's called senshu boe in Japanese. That has not changed. I think this is a change, yes, but it's not gutting Article 9.
Are you surprised it took 70 years after the end of the Second World War for Japan to make this move?
I'm not surprised. Actually, until the end of the Cold War, this was really a non-issue. Yes, you had talk about it, but as long as the Cold War was in place and the U.S. was the main defender of Japan, this was really a non-starter in terms of change. But in the past 20 years, when you see a rising China, you see a more active North Korea, and you see questions about U.S. presence, its deployment changing out of Okinawa, when all these things start happening together, then you have a situation where the argument that Japan should do more for its own defense or that Japan should actually provide more for its allies started actually gaining traction. But the fact that it took 20 years to go from the end of the Cold War up until the change that we see happening, that's natural. It took a long time given that the policy that was in place before then was so well entrenched.
Well, there's still a public opposition to this move. There were some protests in front of the Prime Minister's office on Monday. Do you expect the Japanese public to go along?
I expect to see more protests. When you look at public opinion polls of all the major newspapers and media agencies in Japan, they are split. The more left-leaning newspapers or liberal newspapers are opposed. The more conservative newspapers approve. I expect to see more of these oppositions as we get into the fall when the legislation starts getting written and submitted to the parliament.
Does this change mean a larger Japanese defense force?
That, I think, is still unclear. Definitely, it's a different posture for the Japanese defense force. And right now, the U.S. and Japan are working on their defense guidelines that will delineate the roles and missions of each of their forces. But in terms of whether the Japanese armed forces themselves will expand, my own personal opinion is I don't think so, but that's primarily from budgetary pressures.
Onig says he expects Japan to confine most of its security operations to the Asia-Pacific region. However, in the event of a war in the Middle East that impacts vital oil supplies, he could see Japan participate in international operations using assets like naval minesweepers. Onig says Japan's military is small compared to China's People's Liberation Armed Forces. However, he cites a recent Carnegie Endowment study showing Japan currently maintains a qualitative edge over Chinese forces, although China continues to modernize its military branches. The Nigerian government has condemned the weekend violence in the northern part of the country. Suspected Islamist militants killed more than 50 people Sunday in attacks on churches. Mike O'Meary is a spokesman for the Nigerian government.
Government acknowledges the attack in Kautikeri, Kwada, and Brijuzu local communities about 10 kilometers from Chibok in Borno State. From reports so far, we understand that there are casualties, including amongst the attackers who were shot by the military while attempting to flee the area. At present, government is working closely with local sources and community leaders to ascertain the extent of damage and accurate figures as a result thereof.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said Monday, horrific attacks by Boko Haram are becoming an almost daily occurrence in northeastern Nigeria. He condemned the continuing violence and conveyed his solidarity and sympathy to the people of Nigeria. The April kidnapping in northern Nigeria of hundreds of girls by the terrorist group Boko Haram is still an everyday cause for rage, concern, and increasingly grief. VOA's Adam Phillips attended a street demonstration held regularly by Nigerians living in New York with their sympathizers in front of the Nigerian consulate.
Bring back our girls!
Bring back our girls!
The 100 or so demonstrators representing the Bring Back Our Girls U.S. Coalition were in New York on Friday, trying to keep the fate of over 200 women on people's minds. Moju Baolu Olufunke Okome was one of the leaders who spoke.
Nigerian government, this is a disgrace. I am calling on the Nigerian government.
Yes.
I am still a citizen of Nigeria. Yes. I want to be proud of Nigeria.
Exactly.
I want Nigeria to claim that mantle giant of Africa.
Yes.
The only way it's going to do that is if it secures its people.
Yes.
The only way it's going to do that is if it educates all its children.
Exactly.
The only way it's going to do that in good faith is if any child in Nigeria is as valued as the child of our president.
Yes. Right.
But Okome also wanted everyday passers-by to take heed.
Think about it. If this is your relative, if this is your sister, or this is your daughter, or this is your friend, or this is somebody that comes to your church, or this is somebody that comes to your mosque, how would you feel? The same way you feel if this is somebody that you know personally is how you should feel if any of God's children is in a situation like this girl's. It breaks my heart.
Ronke Olawale, a Nigerian-American, attended a school much like those the abducted girls were attending. She wants them to have the same opportunities she was given.
Girls deserve education. Girls deserve to go to school. Girls have rights. They are children. They are being denied their childhood. They are being abused. They are being molested. They are being forced to take up a religion that they ordinarily would not take. I think it's an infringement on their rights. It's an abuse on their personhood. It's a demeaning of their personality. I feel traumatized for these girls because I can only imagine what they're going through.
Ronka's own daughter, 12-year-old Daniela, nodded sadly at her mother's words. Those girls are crying, she said. They want their families back. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Bring back our girls!
Bring Joshua!
A growing number of Kurdish families in Turkey are calling for the return of their children, who they say have been abducted by the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. The PKK denies the claim, but with the Turkish prime minister stepping in, the dispute is putting pressure on an already stalled peace process. Dorian Jones reports from the main city in Turkey's predominantly Kurdish southeast.
Artık ben dayanamıyorum. Ben artık kokusunu gömleğinden almak istemiyorum. Ben vedatımı kokusunu
istiyorum. In the sweltering summer heat, a group of families hold a daily vigil for their children, who they say were kidnapped by the PKK in recent months. Each carries a photograph of their child. Some were as young as 14 when they disappeared. Suriye Tokla, whose son disappeared 3 months ago, says she's convinced her son was kidnapped by the rebel group. My son couldn't have gone on his own will, she says. He didn't have such love for them. I'm sure he was tricked and didn't go on his own will. The families claim the rebels are holding their children in mountain bases just across the Turkish border in Iraqi Kurdistan. Throughout the 3 decades of conflict, thousands of young Kurdish men and women have gone to the mountains, a euphemism for joining the PKK. Until now, there have been few voices claiming any were kidnapped. But Turkey's Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has stepped in and taken up the family's cause. The dispute comes at a delicate time in the government-initiated peace process with the rebel group. According to Fatma Öncü, a member of the ruling AK Party's National Committee from Diyarbakir, the peace process has allowed people to start speaking out against the PKK. She says women are now coming out to the streets and voicing that their children are being kept in this way. As a party, we're supporting these women in this process in every way, she said. But many pro-Kurdish political groups back the PKK in dismissing claims of abduction. They say all those who join the PKK are volunteers and accuse the government of generating the controversy as a distraction over the lack of progress in the peace process. Edip Yaşar of the Democratic Society Congress, a pro-Kurdish movement, says the claims of abduction are groundless.
Söyleme kim inanır? Aslında hani kargalar güler misali, hükümet söylediğine kendisi de inanmıyor.
Who would believe in such claims of abduction, he says, adding, even the crows will laugh at these statements by the government. Yaşar says the PKK has stated no one under 16 will be given positions in its armed structure, and that the group says it will send back children who want to go home. Back at the family's vigil, the PKK pledge has been met with both scepticism and guarded optimism, according to Suriye Tokla. She says the mothers are determined and won't be going anywhere until their children come back. My son is 14 years old. God willing, he'll be sent back, she says. We are waiting. Let's see. No date has been given by the PKK to return any of the children. Observers say the families could well be pawned in a wider struggle between the government and the pro-Kurdish movement over the stalled peace process. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Diyarbakir.
Here in Washington, President Obama has been dealt a legal and political setback by the High Court in a closely watched case involving his signature health care law and claims of religious liberty. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on the political and legal fallout from the Monday ruling.
On a narrow 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled some corporations are justified in citing religious objections to mandates in the Obama health care law that require businesses to cover emergency contraceptive costs for women employees. The court's 5-member conservative majority said the ruling is limited to smaller companies owned by just a few people and only applies to the birth control provisions in the health care law. The majority opinion said there's no guarantee that religious objections to vaccinations, blood transfusions, or other medical practices covered by health insurance would be upheld. Conservatives hailed the high court ruling as a major legal and political victory. Helen Alvarez is a law professor at George Mason University in Virginia. She spoke on the Supreme Court's steps.
We are so happy the court has upheld religious freedom. We are especially happy that the court continues to allow American families, American businesses, to hold on to their rights of conscience. This is a great day for the political left and the political right, because no matter what administration is in power, our religious freedom cannot be violated.
The 4 liberal justices on the Supreme Court dissented in the case. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg called the case potentially sweeping and said it would put employees who disagree with their employers' religious views at a disadvantage. Dissent was also voiced at the White House by presidential spokesman Josh Earnest.
President Obama believes that women should make personal health care decisions for themselves rather than their bosses deciding for them. Today's decision jeopardizes the health of women who are employed by these companies.
Several women's groups and abortion rights organizations condemned the Supreme Court ruling in a conference call with reporters. Cecile Richards is president of the Planned Parenthood Action Fund.
This decision, not incidentally, made by 5 male justices, sets a dangerous new precedent allowing corporations to interfere in the private health decisions of their employees who happen to be women, and it's women who will pay the price.
Legally, the ruling could lead to other businesses filing challenges to the 4-year-old health care law. 2 years ago, the Supreme Court narrowly upheld the law in a decision where the deciding vote came from Chief Justice John Roberts. Politically, the ruling enhances the chances that the health care law will be a top issue in this year's midterm congressional elections. The Republican Speaker of the House, John Boehner, said the Supreme Court ruling was another defeat for the Obama administration's big government objectives. Women's rights groups say they plan to highlight the ruling in an effort to get women voters out to vote in November to help Democrats hold on to their majority in the U.S. Senate. Republicans are favored to keep or expand their majority in the House of Representatives, and political experts say they have an excellent chance of gaining the 6 seats needed to win back control of the Senate. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington. Put your flags up in
the sky. Put them in the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
The World Cup field will be trimmed to just 8 teams today in Brazil, with 2 matches deciding the final spots in the tournament's quarterfinal round. In Sao Paulo, Lionel Messi leads undefeated Argentina against Switzerland, having scored 4 of his team's 6 goals so far in this World Cup. The Swiss will look to Sheridan Jaquiri, who scored 3 times in the final match of group play. Later in El Salvador, the United States takes on Belgium, which won all of its group matches but did not score in any of those contests until the final 20 minutes. The Americans will get a boost from star forward Jozy Altidore, who was injured in the team's opening win but has been medically cleared to play today. On Monday, France and Germany earned their spots in the quarterfinals. Brazil and Colombia will face off in a quarterfinal match Friday. On Saturday, Costa Rica will play the Netherlands. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On July 1st, 1863, Confederate and Union forces began the Battle of Gettysburg. Many historians regard the battle as the decisive engagement of the American Civil War. On this date in 1867, the British North America Act formed the Dominion of Canada, comprised of the Province of Canada, later Ontario and Quebec, as well as Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. In 1881, the world's first international telephone call was made between New Brunswick in Canada and Maine in the United States. In 1898, future President Theodore Roosevelt and his volunteer cavalry, the so-called Rough Riders, secured the San Juan Heights in Cuba, sealing U.S. victory in the Battle of Santiago during the Spanish-American War. In 1916, nearly 60,000 British soldiers were killed or wounded after the first day of the Battle of the Somme in France during the First World War. In 1921, the Communist Party of China was founded. In 1960, the Republic of Ghana was formed. In 1962, Rwanda and Burundi gained independence. In 1963, a more efficient method of delivering U.S. mail was introduced. The zip code, or zone improvement plan, consisted of a series of five digits added to the mailing address. In 1967, the European communities were formally created out of a merger of the Common Market, the European Coal and Steel Community, and the European Atomic Energy Commission. In 1991, the Warsaw Pact, which allowed the Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, was officially dissolved at a meeting in Prague. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
To all who say that sexual abuse is something so ingrained in wars that it can't be eradicated, make no mistake, we can end sexual warfare conducted against innocent people, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said recently in London at the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence and Conflict. We can establish new norms that respect women, girls, men, and boys, and we can hold those who commit these acts and those who condone them, we can hold them all accountable. Sexual violence is as old as conflict itself. For thousands of years, marauding armies have felt entitled to rape, pillage, and plunder. So why now, Secretary Kerry asked? Because thousands of years after rape had been written into the lexicon of warfare, we know that it is time to write it out and to banish sexual violence to the Dark Ages and the history books where it belongs. Sexual assaults have raged in wars of recent times from Darfur to Goma to Srebrenica. So what do we need to do? Secretary Kerry asked. We need a zero-tolerance policy towards sexual violence against women and men. We need to guarantee, country for country, that we can bring the perpetrators to justice. We need to restore dignity to survivors. And, he stressed, we are committed to making sure that women have a seat at the table in resolving conflicts. When people ask whether or not we can actually outlaw sexual violence in warfare, let me tell you the answer is a resounding yes. Yes, we can achieve this goal, he emphasized. Together with all the people here, men and women, boys and girls, who refuse to remain victims, we rise, Secretary Kerry said in conclusion. We rise. We will go out of here and do the work to end this scourge of sexual violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.